Welcome back to the show. You've got me for another solo episode today. My last three solo episodes, I talked a lot about different categories of body weight, the overweight, the underweight, and the place of perhaps you might be like me and have chosen not to lose weight for a set amount of time because you need to work on other aspects of your health or your strength or your fitness, etc. So I did this because body weight seems to be the biggest focus for people and the number that everyone refers back to as being healthy. But even if we do need to lose weight, we can only lose weight for a certain amount of time in a year, like 20% of a year. Otherwise, we start compromising our health and other aspects of our physiology, our muscle mass, etc. So today I want to focus on all the other numbers that I focus on with clients other than their scale weight. You're going to be surprised how long this list is and amazed at what you can focus on for the rest of the year. So you might want to get out a pen. I am going to do like a little PDF handout for you that you'll be able to download after the show. So you could just sit back and listen or carry on in your walk. But today we're talking about all the numbers you need to focus on.
Welcome to The Body Never Lies. I'm your host, Leela Lutz. Each week, myself and experts from around the world help you uncover the secret ways your body communicates with you to empower you in your own individual health journey.
So like I said, you can only do a fat loss phase for 20% of the year, or you will need like a good break of 6 months in at least of eating at true maintenance to before you can do another fat loss phase if you want to retain your muscle mass and retain your health, which I hope you do because that's what we call healthy and sustainable fat loss. But most people only view health as focusing on that scale weight. And so they get really quickly despondent or they never are truly successful at their health goals because they don't know what else to focus on. And I think this is a product of the industry always being about quick fixes. And obviously, you know, when we can sell crazy results in 12 weeks, with you know, people can make more money and all of the things. But if we want true health and longevity, my job as a health coach is to teach you that, to work out, you know, as a strength and conditioning coach, as a nutrition coach, all of those things, I need to teach you how to be healthy and perform at your best, not just about fat loss. I think what you'll be surprised today at just all of the things that we focus on in health and how much more there is than just fat loss. So I'm going to take you through all those numbers. And I hope that this will give you something to focus on next year with your health goals. So like I said, only 20% of the year we can be in a fat loss phase. The rest of the year, we need to be maintaining or building up our health. So the first thing to me is that I always assess with everybody is their body temperature and their pulse rate. Now, you guys would have heard me talking about body temperature quite in depth in the thyroid episode, the thyroid 101. So you can go back and listen to that. But I will explain it a little bit today, just in the context of the episode. And perhaps if this is your first time joining me on the podcast. So the body temperature and pulse method was developed by Broda Barnes, who is an endocrinologist, and it has been used by other general practitioners as well and other doctors, etc. Dr. Ray Pete, other practitioners. I remember the first time I spoke to my functional medicine doctor and talked about how I was using it to measure myself and how I measured to clients. And she looked at me and she said, I can't believe she get people to do it. So she knew of it and she had read, she's known about it as a true method. And a lot of doctors do. It's just that they stopped using it and shifted over to blood tests. Blood tests can be quite limited because, of course, you have to go and get them regularly, which costs money and we're taking blood and it takes time, etc. And then you normally get them sent to the doctor and the doctor looks at them and you have to pay the doctor to go and talk to them about the tests. I do order private tests for clients, but they are a lot more expensive, obviously. And, you know, it's not an easy and accessible way to assess your health. The other problem with it is, of course, as well, is that what's in the blood is, like, we just think of the blood, and again, I talked about this a lot in the thyroid episode, we talk about the blood as a superhighway that transports nutrients, hormones, etc., from cell to cell. So we can only measure what's in transport. We cannot measure what is happening at the cellular level. We can only make an assumption that either the cell didn't take up what was in the blood, so there's an excess in the blood, or that there's too little in the blood, or, you know, like, we have to make assumptions, basically, what I'm saying. So in the case of TSH, thyroid stimulating hormone, that is a pituitary hormone, not a thyroid hormone. We're measuring how much thyroid stimulating hormone is in the blood that came from the pituitary, but we don't know if that's just what was released by the pituitary, or there's more in the pituitary. So is the pituitary over functioning or under functioning? And then we're also making an assumption based on whether the thyroid took up what was in the blood or didn't take up what was in the blood. So maybe it did take up a lot, maybe it didn't take up a lot. So we're taking guesses based on what's in between the two organs. And the same goes for any other blood, you know, any other thing that we're testing in the blood, basically. So it is limited. It also, you know, is inhibited by factors like exercise and stress. So you can have different blood tests from one day to the next. And so it's not necessarily as reliable as we'd like it to be. I do use blood tests with my clients, but I use them in context with temperature and pulse. And what I love about temperature and pulse, of course, is that it is really inexpensive and really non-invasive. So you can do it at home yourself. And we can look at it in real time. We can look at it against blood tests. We look at it against food. And it gives us a lot of information. And it actually, when I look at it against blood tests, it gives me more information than the blood tests on their own. So, like I said, we can't test what's at the cell level. But our body is made up of cells, and every single organ in our body is made up of millions of cells, trillions of cells. So like your heart, for instance, has 2 to 3 million cells in the cardiac muscles. To function, each cell needs to be able to receive energy and produce heat at the cellular level. And to create energy, at the cell level, it needs oxygen, glucose, which is carbohydrate, and thyroid hormone, active thyroid hormone. And when those three things happen at the cellular level, heat is created. You know, it's like it's your fuel source. Your energy actually burns and you use it to do things with your body. In states of low energy availability, sometimes called low thyroid states or low metabolic states, the energy going to the cell, so the oxygen or the glucose or the thyroid, is limited or it is blocked, and then there will be less heat. So this is where using basal temperature is a really effective way of measuring what's going on at the cell level. Because again, as I said in the blood test, we can't tell what's going on at the cell. We can only understand whether there was too little or there was no uptake. And that in itself is really actually hard to ascertain from blood test. So you might know, like I've known my whole life that I had low energy availability because I was one of those people who always had freezing cold hands, freezing cold feet, and a really cold nose. So that's more of an extreme. Some people won't have that. That's like an extreme low energy availability. And you'll see this with thin people, right? They're always cold. They always need more layers. And we sort of say, oh, well, because you've got less fat on you. But it's also because being at a low body weight, as you would have heard in my podcast episode on low body weight, is achieved by a constant caloric restriction. And I'm hard-pressed to actually meet someone who sits at a body weight lower than the recommended for their height who actually is that way in a functional, physiological way. So when we don't have enough energy, the body will try and conserve energy. So it will draw the heat towards the organs, the most important parts of the body. The number one most important part being the brain, of course. And then it will conserve energy for things. So it withdraws away from the extremities. And then it will also start to slow down digestion, slow down hormone production, slow down all of the things to try and conserve energy. And so when we take our armpit temperature, if it is low, we can assume that the body does not have enough energy to create the heat that it needs to function. So normal basal body temperature, sorry, I always have to look up the Fahrenheit. I don't know why I should never remember the Fahrenheit, is 97.8 to 98.6 Fahrenheit, or 36.6 to 37 degrees Celsius. Something that's really important when you take your temperature and pulse is to always take your armpit temperature. Because your brain requires the most glucose in your body, you can often have that being preferenced over your corpse. So your armpit will be lower than your oral temperature. So I have quite a lot of people who have normal oral temperature and they'll have a low armpit temperature, but they've only been taking the oral temperature. They're like, Leela, that doesn't work. It's fine. There's nothing wrong with me. And then we take armpit temperature and it's significantly lower. Also, the taking the oral temperature can produce false positives, because the problem is if you can't breathe properly or you have a nasal or sinus infection, you can have more heat in the head than you would normally. And so that can give us a false positive. And I just find so many people have restricted breathing patterns and airways now. For them to close their mouth and hold a thermometer in their mouth gives a lot of false positives. But I do like to take them together, because the two of them together show me things as well. There should only be a difference of like 0.2 degrees between the oral and the armpit temperatures. So this is the first number and the number that I use the most. So what will happen as well throughout the day, we are normally the coldest when we wake up. And then once we eat breakfast, we should see a rise in temperature, and then lunch. And then we should have our highest temperature in the afternoon, evening, because the more food we're giving ourselves, the more fuel we can create, the more heat that we can create, provided that the fuel is appropriate, right? So I do have clients, and this is what I use body temperature for as well, is giving themselves the wrong kinds of foods, which are actually costing their body more energy. And so there will be a drop in body temperature. So I do measure it against foods. You know, for instance, with people who fasted for a long time, for instance, when they start eating breakfast, again, they'll actually often get a worse temperature and pulse after breakfast than before breakfast, because the meal has stressed the body out too much. This does not mean that they should not eat breakfast. It means that we have work to do to get them functioning and able to eat breakfast, because we should have a nice warm temperature after breakfast. So we generally take temperature and pulse when you wake up, and then 60 to 90 minutes after breakfast, and 60 to 90 minutes to after lunch, and then we log it against your food and activity. So I can also tell whether you can get into the recovery state. So when I work with people who have exercise intolerance, I say that in air quotes, they just have a negative response to exercise because the physiology is not working in the right way. We use temperature and pulse to ascertain the dose, the effective dose of exercise. If they have too much of a drop in temperature the day after training, we know that maybe that stress was a little bit much and we can pull it back a bit. But generally what we want is, again, when someone's doing the right type of exercise for them, it actually boosts their metabolism as well. And so we would see consistent body temperature and pulse the next day. We must also understand that body temperature and pulse is affected by the menstrual cycle. And it's another great way actually to measure your menstrual cycle. When you bleed, the first day of you're bleed, you should have the highest temperature of the month, and then it will drop until you ovulate. And once you, so at ovulation, it will be at its lowest point for the month. And then after you ovulate, it will climb back up again from the period of ovulation to the bleed again. So we can use it to tell if we've ovulated. And of course, ovulation is really important because that's how we make our hormones. If I don't see that smooth rise from ovulation to the bleed, I can also make the assumption that that client doesn't have enough progesterone and might need help with those kinds of things. But it's normal. What I'm saying is it's normal to see it drop and rise within the month. But again, it should be only like 0.2 to 0.5 degrees of a drop. And when you drop after ovulation, you don't want to be dropping into like 35. So the pulse, the thing with the pulse as well, I know that there is a lot of nuance to this. There is. And a low pulse can be seen as a sign of fitness. But I would say that someone who is really fit would have a pulse still in the 60s and not in the 50s and definitely not in the 40s. Your heart is a muscle, and it can, when it contracts, it pumps blood around the body. In low energy states, it's not going to get as much energy, and so the rate of pulsation is going to be less. The rate of contraction is going to be less. And we see this in all muscles in the low energy availability state. One of the tests for low thyroid is Achilles tendon reflex. And so your heart, just like any other muscle in your body, will beat slower, have less response due to the lack of energy. So it's really important when someone says, oh, I'm really fit and so I have a low heart rate. I've been working with someone recently who's really athletic and their heart rate was in the 40s and we've been slowly getting it back up, and it's actually got back into the 60s now, which is much healthier. And, you know, we have to be really careful too, because when we look at like some of these old, these athletes and ultra marathon runners, et cetera, we see a lot of them ending up getting pacemakers and having heart problems. I remember one of the spin instructors at my gym actually died of a heart attack in his 40s. And, you know, he always had a super low heart rate and said he was super fit and healthy. So we need to look at this low heart rate in context. It is, if you are an endurance athlete and you don't eat your energetic requirements, and a lot of people don't realize that endurance athletes can need like 300 to 500 grams more carbohydrate than other athletes. Yet they do these ultra marathon events and they can go for really long times without food. So this low energy availability can go hand in hand. We see it with female athletes as well. Female athletes, about 70% of female athletes are underfed. So that's something to think about when we talk about pulse. So when I was diagnosed as being hyperthyroid, so overactive thyroid, it's a completely wrong diagnosis. And I wish I had known this at the time. I might not be suffering so badly later in life. But I was diagnosed as hyperthyroid, overactive thyroid. So I had really low TSH. So the assumption is made that my thyroid was just burning through the thyroid stimulating hormone. So there was none in the blood. And I had a super high heart rate. I actually thought I had a heart condition, because I got off the spin bike after teaching a class. My heart rate was 220 beats per minute. It took like hours to come down, and it only came down to about 180. I was dizzy. I was having all these issues. I turned up at the hospital. I did lots of tests, and there was nothing wrong with my heart's function per se, but it actually was found that I was hyperthyroid. And a high heart rate is indicative of overactive thyroid. However, my temperature, I was freezing. My hands were freezing. My toes were freezing. My nose was freezing. And I was like wearing these puffer jackets, you know, and then it wasn't winter. And what that actually means is that I had a massive surge of adrenaline, and I actually had an underactive thyroid. And yeah, thinking back to it, I wish I had known that and actually challenged the endocrinologist, because of course she medicated me to suppress my thyroid function. And 2 weeks later, I had my thyroid totally bottomed out, and I've been struggling with low thyroid function ever since. And we will never know if my thyroid bottomed out because of the huge amount of medication that she gave me, or if it was going to bottom out anyway. The next thing I would say look at would be blood pressure. And blood pressure is really important because, again, as the blood vessels are a muscular part of your musculoskeletal system, the ability for them to contract and relax to put up with the pressure of the blood going through is dependent as well on the electron transport chain, or dependent on the energy availability. And we can see high blood pressure in really high stress states, and we can see low blood pressure in low energy availability, low thyroid states. So that's something also to have a look at that I might get clients to monitor as well with their body temperature and pulse. And it can be when you've got someone who's got that, then they say that's a fitness adaptation. I normally see low blood pressure when their pulse is too low as well, and it's a backup checkpoint for them. So you'll know if you have low blood pressure, if you get up from sitting down and stand up suddenly and you get that feeling of like your body takes a long time to catch up with you, or you get dizzy, or you get quite faint doing things, that's low blood pressure. And, you know, I have a lot of clients who've had high blood pressure and their doctors want to treat it with medication, but we actually can treat it with managing health and energy availability and stress, because, of course, there are side effects from taking blood pressure medication, and the cascade of that is really alarming as well. Of course, this is not medical advice. You should check with your doctor on that one. So blood pressure is really helpful. My third measure is respiratory rate. So how many times do you breathe in and out in a minute? So as I said, oxygen getting to the cell level is a really important part of energy. And to be able to get oxygen into the cell level, we need to be able to retain enough carbon dioxide. So if we can't utilize carbon dioxide, what you will find is that people breathe quite quickly because they're trying to get rid of all the carbon dioxide. Now, so a good breathing rate is around 12 to 14 beats per minute. So this is something really easy to test yourself with. You can just put a timer on your phone for a minute and just sit there and relax and just breathe in and out and count how many breaths you are breathing. I always do this when people don't know. I can measure it while people don't know I'm doing it, because of course, once you know that you're being tested for it, you can slow your breath down. Some of the wearables measure it, and they're not as accurate, but it can give you a day-to-day sort of indication of where you're at. You know, I really notice when I'm with people and they take, you know, you're just sitting in silence and they take a lot of breaths when you're just sitting there not talking. It really is a sign of not being able to retain carbon dioxide. And that doesn't mean that you're unfit per se. It just means that the energy cannot get into the cell. You're not able to use that carbon dioxide to push the oxygen into the cell. And we see this very much in the people who have exercise intolerance. They generally have a high breathing rate because they can't retain that carbon dioxide. So a lot of it also has to do with your carbohydrate consumption and your ability to utilize carbohydrates, because carbohydrate, glucose, and oxygen go into the cell together. They need each other to go into the cell. So the next thing I'm going to say, now I feel like those are the three kind of main ones that I test people for, you know, as a benchmark, where are you at with your health? And then the other ones are the things that I more focus on day to day, and the things that you can focus on day to day. And then you would come back and retest those first three or four, if you count the pulse, you know, a month later. So a big one that everyone needs to know is their average step count. We live in a day and age where we all sit all day because we work on computers. I sit all day. And so I really need to be conscious of my step count. Now, the minimum step count should be 7,000 steps per day. I would say good is 10,000 steps, but the research shows that 7,000 is the benchmark, and this is where they see better health outcomes. If you want to be fit though and you want to burn fat and put on muscle and all of the things, I would aim for 10,000. And you don't need a step counter. Generally, if you look at your phone, there'll be a step counter in your phone. You just take it with you when you're walking and just make more of an effort to walk places, right? Like I do think one of the beauties of where I live is I live quite close to the city and everything is walking distance. I walk everywhere. I walk to the gym. I walk to drop my daughter at school. I walk to the shops. And so for me, and I also have a three-story house, so I'm up and down the stairs all day. So despite the fact that I work, I sit at a computer, it's pretty easy for me to hit 10,000 steps. That's pretty much what I average every day. I also have a dog and I walk my dog everywhere. So that generally takes me to 12,000, 15,000 steps. But most people, you know, when I first started, I had to be really intentional about it. I used to work in the gym. I was on my feet all day. I would have done 15,000, 20,000 steps a day. I also had a dog and went for walks with him. But when I came to doing an office job, I had to be really intentional about it. And it amazes me when I go to the dog park and I see everyone sitting on the wall, all the benches at the dog park while their dogs play, while they're on their phone. We need to be intentional about getting these steps in. And I recommend doing them 2 to 3 separate intervals in the day and sometime around after each meal, which will help you utilize your physiology to burn the right fuel source after eating. So your insulin receptivity is going to be better from walking. So start with a 10-minute walk after breakfast, a 10-minute walk after lunch, and a 10-minute walk after dinner, and see how you go with that. And then add 1,000 steps every week until you get to your goal. So the next thing after that, I would talk about your breathing count when you're doing steps. So when we're doing zone 2, which is basically what walking is, we close our mouth and we breathe in and out through our nose. So I know people say that the talk test means that you're in zone 2. However, when you're talking, you're wasting a lot of carbon dioxide. So if you want to improve your respiratory function and your metabolic health and get oxygen into the cell, I would close your mouth and breathe in and out through your nose. And also you want to do this nice and slowly. So I would try and breathe in for 4 counts and exhale for 4 counts out of my nose and keep that breathing rate for your walk. If you want to get really good at this and really good at retaining carbon dioxide, I would breathe in for 4 counts, hold your breath for 4 counts, breathe out for 4 counts, and hold your breath for 4 counts. So you might only be able to do this for a couple of minutes. That's okay. I try and dedicate one of my walks to just doing that for 10 minutes. And then you'll be surprised at how much fitter you get and how much your breathing rate will improve from doing that. Another number that I want to focus on and I check with every single client is their total caloric intake. And I'm not doing this to see if they're overeating generally. I'm generally doing it to see if they're eating enough. The best thing to do is go to the TDEE.calculator.net to work out what you should be eating in calories. And a lot of people will be surprised how much they should be eating. So yes, you need to be in a caloric deficit to lose weight. However, you should only be in a caloric deficit for 20% of the year. And then at the end of your caloric deficit, you need to reverse back up to your maintenance calories. And you need a healthy amount of maintenance calories to be able to maintain your weight and maintain your health. So if you're like me and you exercise 5 to 6 times a week, you're going to have a high maintenance calories to be able to perform and get the benefits from your training. If you have high muscle mass, you're going to need more maintenance calories. And that's one of the reasons why you put on muscle mass. So you have more efficient metabolism, but also you get the pleasure of eating more food and not having to diet. So I would always check someone's caloric intake. So you would I use Chronometer. I recommend Chronometer, and I'll talk about that more in a minute. But I would take Chronometer and I would just write down every single thing that you eat, every single thing that goes into your mouth for 2 weeks, so 14 days. And I say 14 days because people generally eat differently on the weekend than they do during the week. And you need to take those 14 days and then add all of the calories up for the 14 days and then divide it by 14 to get the average. So if you're a person that eats 1,000 calories Monday to Friday but eats 3,000 calories, sorry, Monday to Thursday, but eat 3,000 calories on Friday, Saturday, Sunday, your average is not going to be 1,000 calories. So maybe you would be overeating per se, but we need to get a general idea of, are you able to meet your energetic needs by giving yourself enough calories? Of course, not all calories are created equal, and we'll look at that later. But this is a huge problem I see with people. Like I said, they'll eat like 1,000 calories a day during the week, and then they will just binge, or they go out a lot, so they end up having a lot of calories over the weekend. The next thing I want to look at is grams of fat. How much fat do you eat? Chronomine is great for this because it really breaks the fat down. We'll go into that more in another episode, but Chronomine breaks the fats down from saturated, monounsaturated and polyunsaturated, and that's really important to have the right ratios of those. But in general, our total fat intake should be 20% of our total calories, maybe 30% for some people if they have like a lot of muscle mass, but generally around 20% or 0.8 grams per kilo of desired body weight. Everyone is overeating fat. Even if they're eating healthy fat, you still can't eat as much fat as you want. We need to have more protein and more carbohydrate than fat going in. And we know if we eat too much fat, it actually blocks energy getting into the cell again. Okay. And we can use fat when we're sitting at rest, but we can't use fat when we're thinking, walking around, exercising. We can't use fat as fuel. So then we start to damage our metabolism. So fat, 0.8 grams per kilo of desired body weight. If you've been enjoying all the episodes of The Body Never Lies, but you're wondering, Leela, where do I even start with implementing all these great things that I'm learning? Well, I've created something just for you, and I'm so passionate about you getting access to it that I am giving it away for free. The Body Never Lies Insights course helps women over 35 who are sick of all the tests with no answers uncover the root cause of their long list of unexplained symptoms with a scientifically proven self-assessment tool. Over 4 live workshops, I'm going to take you through the assessment that I take every single client through to help them establish where they are truly at with their health. The assessment includes all the things that their doctor and quite a lot of other practitioners, to be honest, have never asked them, and will leave you feeling 100% certain that no, it is not all in your head. Your body never lies. Whether you've been eating clean and self-researching for years, maybe you're sick of giving up all of the different food groups, maybe you've tried a few pro-metabolic approaches and it's made you worse, or even if you've just arrived at a crossroads of knowing you need to do something different for your health and you don't know where to start, this assessment tool is for you. If you want to get this for free, and I probably won't do this again, then head over to thebodyneverlies.com.au and register now. We are starting on January 15, so you can make 2025 your best year yet. Of course, places are limited, so make sure you get in because it is first in, best dressed. The next thing I look at is protein. Protein, I still see a lot of people who undereat their protein. Oh, I want to go back and say something about fat. The other thing about Chronomine that's really good is that 1 gram of fat equals 9 calories and 1 gram of carbohydrate or protein equals 4 calories. So the value of fat is double the carbs and the protein, and Chronomine actually shows you in a visual circle what your fat consumption looks like for the day as a percentage. So when you go to a shop and you read the label, the fat grams, if you had 50 grams, so you had 10 grams of fat and you had 10 grams of protein, you think, oh, that's equal, but it's not, because it's actually 90 calories of fat and only 40 calories of protein. So your fat is double your protein. We don't want that. We want the protein to be more than the fat and the carbs to be more than the fat. We want the carbs to be around 20 to 30% of the total meal. So Chronomine is great because it gives you this visual representation that you can see that your total fat for the day is in, it's in red fat too, which is really important because red is like danger if we go over. So you can have a look. Is my daily fat intake over 20, 25, 30%, depending on your needs? One of the reasons why I love Chronometer. We'll come back. There's lots of reasons why I love Chronometer. We'll talk about some more in a minute. Protein. Now, everyone's getting, protein's getting a massive rap, which is awesome because most of the people I see are under-eating protein, or if they're hitting their protein target, they're massively overeating fat because they don't know how to balance that. Something I teach you in my course, by the way. But protein, we need to be eating 1.6 to 2.2 per kilogram of desired body weight, okay? You know, 65 kilos is like my goal body weight, so 130, 140 grams of protein is enough protein for me. There is no evidence to say that eating more protein does anything beneficial for you. So there's no need to eat more than 2.2 grams. So what I'm finding with the people who've jumped on the protein wagon and they're following all these influencers with these high protein meals is they're going over, and it's just a waste. You just don't need to do that. Protein is probably in the food, all the food that you're going to eat, the most expensive food, especially if you're getting it from organic meats and organic dairies, organic animal products. It's the most expensive part of your shopping list. So there's no point going over it. It's just a waste. And then the rest of what we're going to be eating is the carbohydrates. So you generally take your total calories that you should be eating, put in what your fat should be, put in what your protein should be, and then you subtract that from the total calories and the rest should be carbs. And that should be around 5 to 7 grams per kilo of desired body weight, 5 to 7 grams. It's going to be more if you're training. Now, my favorite thing about carbohydrates is that they're protein sparing. So if you don't eat enough carbohydrates, your body takes the protein that you ate and turns it into carbohydrate. So you're wasting, spending all that money again on protein, but you're not able to utilize the protein to its full effect. So if you need that 140 grams of protein and you want it to work for you, well, guess what? You need to eat enough carbohydrate to be able to make that work for you. So carbs, everyone's become so scared of carbohydrates. My word, there's so much misinformation out there about carbohydrates and we're really missing this essential nutrient. So what we're going to look at too, for my next point, is going to be the total calories. You need to ascertain, are you overeating or are you undereating? Some people are overeating some things but undereating other things. So if you're overeating, I would decrease the total calories by 20%, or I would decrease the macro that you're overeating. You know, if it's fat, I would decrease it like 5 to 10 grams at a time. If you're overeating protein, same thing goes. Don't really see that many people overeating carbohydrates unless they're eating like the standard American or standard Australian diet. But I generally work more with people who've come from a clean eating background and have all these kind of ideas about food. And most of those people are under eating. So if you're under eating, you know, like nobody should be eating less than 2,000 calories on a day-to-day basis. And like a meal is at least 500 calories, at least. You know, I sort of eat 700, 800 calorie meals. If you're not eating 500 calorie meals, like if you eat 3 meals a day of 500 calories, that's 1500 calories. That's not a lot of food. So you could be having snacks on top of that. Yes, fair enough. But your meals need to be at least 500 calories. That's another number for you to check. So if you're under eating, you really need to look at the numbers and start increasing by 50 calories a week. Now, some people need to increase 50 calories and wait a month, because they're so low in energetic function. You know, you actually need energy to break the food down. So you're going to give it a bit of energy and let it learn to utilize that energy so it can break food down properly. You know, if we go too fast, and this is what we see with the pro-metabolic diet people, there's no such thing as a pro-metabolic diet, by the way, or the Ray-Pete diet. People going, oh my God, I need carbohydrates. I should be eating carbohydrates, and just putting carbohydrates back in. No. I want you to put in 50 calories of carbohydrates per week, which is like 12 grams of carbohydrate per week, if not per month, and add that slowly. Okay. So these are really important numbers to focus on. Do I eat enough? and do, am I meeting all my needs? Meeting all my needs also, it's not just about macros. We've talked about macros, but the thing that I love about Chronometer is looking at your recommended dietary intake or your RDIs. Sometimes when I'm working with someone, I just get them to focus purely on increasing the micronutrient value of all of their foods, right? So if you scroll down in your page in Chronometer, you'll see that it tells you all of the vitamins, all of the minerals, everything that you need in your diet. So apart from like A, D, K, and E, and maybe iodine, I would be trying to hit all those numbers. It's really important to note that like the recommended dietary intakes as well are based on like 1800 calories. It's pretty hard to hit your RDIs in less than 1800 calories. And even if you were doing it in 1800 calories, it would take a serious amount of planning and being really intentional about the food that you eat to actually hit them in 1800 in calories. Like I'm about to do a fat loss phase and I'm planning out my fat loss phase so I can still hit all of the vitamins, minerals, and micronutrients that I need to hit in that fat loss phase. Because for your body to make energy, it can't just have calories. It needs micronutrients, minerals, and vitamins to take that food and turn it into energy. So, you know, we're so quick these days to throw supplements at people when we really should just be looking at their food log and say, are you meeting the recommended dietary intake that you need to function? So, and it's important to remember that the recommended dietary intake is based off minimal amount, you know, it's based off not starving. It's not based off thriving and amazing performance. So I often encourage people, if you're going to do anything, just look at Chronometer and look at your RDIs and try and slowly increase all of the RDIs in your day-to-day food and make them consistent every day. Not like, you know, I have a ton of zinc on one day a month and then I don't have any zinc for the rest of the month or whatever it is. So you'll be surprised as well when you increase your food. And now I'm up at 2,600 calories. And I have to say that I should be eating 2,800 calories. And I've started to notice I'm ready to go up to the next level because I get really hungry all of a sudden after training. So I'm ready to go up to 2,650, 2,700. But you'll be surprised how bloody easy it is to hit all your RDIs when you can eat that much food and you're eating from the list of foods that people will call pro-metabolic foods or the bio energy that have good energy bioavailability, how easy it is to hit all your RDIs. So I would say also on the food part, making sure that your macros are spread evenly throughout the day. ED, for example, you have 15 to 20 grams of protein per snack. You have 20 to 30 grams of protein per meal. And you would keep that consistent. So work on the protein bit first. That will help you keep you satiated and help balance your blood sugar. But then the same goes with the carbohydrates. You know, I try and hit 80 grams of carbohydrate per meal. I have four meals a day and it's 80 grams every time. You could get into, when you get into nutrient partitioning, you might front load your carbohydrates before and after training. I started doing that as well. And then I have like a smaller meal at dinner because I do my training in the morning. I don't need as much energy in the evening and also I'm going to sleep. So I don't want all of that food sitting in my tummy. So really try and spread your macros out evenly through the day. And this is where people start to realize that they don't plan ahead and how planning ahead, failing to plan ahead does them. Because you'll get to 4 o'clock and you're like, oh my God, I haven't hit my carbohydrate intake. I'm just going to go and eat a ton of carbs now and then wonder why they feel crap for a couple of hours after dinner every night. We can't, you know, that is a whole lot of stress on your body, pushing all your calories to the evening. We know that people who eat the most amount of calories in the evening have the worst blood sugar in the morning, have high cholesterol, all these things. So we need to pre-plan and actually hit our calories either evenly through the day or push them more around training, the carbs more around training and the fats away from training. Meal timing consistency as well is a big one. Like set times to eat and stick to them. Like if you train You need to eat before training. You need to eat after training to get the best benefits from training, right? We don't always want to be thinking of like, I'm going to burn fat when I'm training. So I want to train faster so I will burn more fat. It's not how it works. You will actually use up muscle glycogen and so you will waste muscle mass. And the more muscle mass you have, the better you are at burning fat at rest anyway. So you want to front load your training with some carbohydrates and protein and eat straight after training. You probably want to have the most of your carbohydrates for the day straight after training because that's when your insulin receptivity is the highest and the insulin will shunt that carbohydrate straight to your muscles. It's going to be utilized the best straight after training. So you want to eat within half an hour of training. So, you know, chrononutrition is such an underrated thing. So chrononutrition is basically eating according to your circadian rhythms and also your hormones. So you have the highest amount of stress hormones in the morning. So you eat most of your food in the morning and then you eat less in the evening when you're about to go to sleep and get into the state of rest and repair and recovery. You don't want to be digesting food in the night and interrupting your rest and recovery and repair. So set times to eat and stick to them. Set amounts of food to eat at meals and stick to them too. Now I want to come to your training numbers. So I want you to know that most people I work with have no idea of what is a basic amount of strength, and especially women because they're so afraid of putting on muscle mass, or, you know, they follow so many programs as well that are just kind of hopping from one thing to the next, one thing to the next. So they never actually can get strong enough. So you're not necessarily going to get super jacked from just achieving a baseline of strength. You won't. Don't worry about it. You're going to get super jacked if you lift really heavy, and maybe you want to get super jacked. That's cool too. But I'm just letting all the women out there who are afraid of putting on muscle, or they're wondering why their bone mineral density is not increasing or whatever it is. You need to meet the basic amount of strength requirements. So the strength norm, I would say, one, being able to carry 75% of your body weight for 1 minute. So like if you're doing a farmer's walk, so say for me, like I should be able to carry 35 kilogram dumbbells, one in each hand, for 1 minute while I'm walking around, okay? Hang for 1 minute. So you should be able to put your arms up on the chin-up bar and hang there passively for 1 minute. And these two exercises exhibit good shoulder health and good arm strength. So passive, so sort of more passive exercise. But then when we look at the big lifts, like your back squat, so popping a bar on your back and squatting for 10 reps, we should be able to squat 1.25 times our body weight. So for me, that's about 80 kilos for 10 reps. Deadlift, we should be able to do one times your body weight. Now, this is where I was talking about in the other episode, how much stronger my deadlift is from my back squat. And so my deadlift is like easily 80 kilos, which is actually strong, a good amount of strength. And my back squat was like 60 kilos max, you know, so I was like, they're actually out of whack in terms of strength norm. So I have to work more on my back squat and stop focusing so much on deadlifts because I love it and it's easy. I was like, oh, I'm just going to set a goal for 100 kilo deadlift and completely ignore my wimpy little back squat. So back squat, 1.25 times your body weight, deadlift one times your body weight. Bench press. Now, as women, we're obviously much stronger in our legs. Like we have most of our muscle mass in our legs and not so much in our upper body. So our strength level compared to men is less anyway, because we're just less strong. We have less testosterone. We carry more body fat, like just naturally we're less strong and that's fine. But comparative to men, our upper body strength is much weaker relative to the rest of us. So normal for bench press for women is 0.7 times your body weight or your desired body weight. And then lunging, so step back lunges, we would say half your body weight in lunges because you're going one leg at a time. So increasing on top of that obviously is amazing, but this is just a basic strength level. And there's not that many women that I see at the gym who can do that. There's not that many women that I meet in sessions that can do that. And that is achievable if you had a really great program and you were training twice a week, you would be able to achieve those. So you don't have to be this crazy gym goer to get to those basic levels of strength. What you do need is a great coach who can teach you the right technique and teach you how to wind up tension in each of the lifts so that you can get your whole body working for you to get strong enough to do them. You do need enough food. You need enough calories. Like, I can't tell you how much stronger I've gotten in the last phase, like really pushing my carbs up. Like, I cannot wait to see next year when I get up to 2,800 calories, just how much stronger I can get. And you guys will see me. Like, I'm not that muscly. I don't look that jacked. Like, it takes a long time to get that kind of physique. So women, stop being afraid. Stop being afraid and go for those strength norms. So the other thing as well is progressive overload. So when you need to have some way of recording your training session, and you need to do the same shit over and over and over again and get better at it every time. So my thing when I'm training, and I always say to clients too, is to gamify your training. I'm going to beat last week. And so some weeks I'll beat last week massively, and some weeks I'll just beat last week like a tiny bit. So say if I hadn't had enough sleep, or some weeks I don't beat everything, some things just stay the same. So say, for instance, I haven't had a good amount of sleep, I'm not going to push to beat last week massively, but I might go for more volume. Like, I feel a bit weaker, so I might drop the weight a little bit, so I'll go for more volume. And then when you take the weights times the sets times the reps, the volume will equal more than last week. So this is where it's helpful to have a trainer who can teach you how to play around with volume and the sets and the tempo, so that even if you can't lift as heavy a weight, you can still increase somewhat from the week before. And especially when you've got like weights, I've been too lazy to get those little discs to stick on the end of the dumbbells and on some of the plate loaded machines, because sometimes the increase, like from going from 10 to 12 and a half kilo dumbbells to 15 kilo dumbbells to 17 and a half kilo dumbbells, like they're quite big jumps in between those dumbbells. And I see a lot of people just can't get over, say, 12 and a half to get to 15. But you can actually play around with the volume a lot and kind of do a pyramid thing with the volume and then get to the next weight. So it's a little bit of a technical and bit of a strategic approach at progressive overload, rather than just trying to push five sets of 12 every single week. Like, you can play around with the volume and whatnot, and especially according to your cycle and how much sleep you've had. And this is, if you have a trainer, this is what they should be doing for you, by the way, is finding a way for you to beat last week every week and making sure that you do demonstrate progressive overload. So every session is better. So you will know if you're growing muscle, if you're continually seeing increases in progressive overload in your sessions. So your overall goal, so progressive overload, beat last week. So your overall goal, right, is going to be my back squat. I'm going to back squat my body weight. I talk about this a lot in the episode with Amy about me trying to get my hack squat better. I had an injury and I became afraid of squatting, and I had to build up the confidence again, and I've had to build up the stability. I've had to build up the ability to take the pressure of the load and all the things. So my goal next year sometime is to hit this body weight squat, and then it is to hit beyond that. But this is the really important thing with people. If you just go like, I can't squat and I'm supposed to be able to squat 80 kilos, you just look at that and you go, shit. Like, I put the bar on my back and it's uncomfortable, or whatever it is. When you set a goal, you have to make it into mini goals, right? So I was like, okay, well, I'm going to hack squat because there's less stability required with the hack squat, so I can just focus on the strength component. So then I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to build up to my body weight in hack squat. So I got to 70 kilos. just yesterday, actually. So that was my first goal. And, you know, but even in that goal, beyond that, there were smaller goals because the HackSpot machine actually weighs 40 kilos. So I had to be able to do full depth hack squats with just the machine to start with really good technique. And so when I got that, I gave myself a little pat on the back and I celebrated. I didn't go out and party or spend money on something to celebrate. I just really acknowledged that I had achieved my first mini goal. That was a big thing for me. I was really scared of going full depth because of the pressure that happens when you go do that, because I had a DMT some time ago. And, you know, that was a big milestone for me, overcoming that and getting the technique really good for that. And also a lot of ankle mobility went into that and a whole lot of stuff. And it's really important that you have these big goals, but within those you have mini goals. And every time you achieve a mini goal, you acknowledge that and you celebrate it. Because otherwise it's going to feel like forever to get to the big goal. The same is like with weight loss. So you can only lose weight, you can only be in a caloric deficit for a certain amount of time. So for me, I've planned out next year and I'm going to need to do 2 fat loss phases to get to my goal. So there's only a certain amount of weight that I can lose. There's only a certain amount of time that I can be in a caloric deficit. And it's about going, well, it's not realistic for me to lose 15 kilos in one go. It's not healthy. So I'm going to break that down into 2 chunks and I'm going to go for 7 kilos at each time, or whatever the goal is. Like, break it down into a smaller goal and accept that not everything can happen overnight unless there's some kind of extreme sacrifice or extreme commitment to an extreme program. Like, if you want extreme result, we have to take extreme measures. And normally with extreme measures come extreme costs, okay? So when I work with someone and I see that they need to lose weight, but they don't know how to do maintenance, well, one of the goals is going to be doing maintenance really well, increasing muscle mass, increasing output, increasing everything so that we have more metabolic flexibility. And what that means is when you do go into a fat loss phase, you will actually lose more fat in the fat loss phase, if that makes sense. So it's about looking at the big picture. Like, I hope by giving you all these numbers today and all the numbers that I use to work with when I work with a client and I plan out their year, and if you come along and do my course with me next year, you will plan out your year too, because you can't be in a fat loss phase forever. We're going to go, what are all the things from this list that are coming up as deficits or that are not optimal? And I need to find a place in the year to work on those, because, for instance, you can't get stronger at the same time as being a fat loss phase. You can lose fat while you put on muscle, but it's only for like quite a small amount in your training life. So if you're new to training, so you've never trained before, you can sit at maintenance and lose fat and gain muscle at the same time. Like, the more you've trained in your life, the less likely that is to happen. And you have to train quite hard to make it happen. So there's, you know, we have to look at the person and say, well, what can you achieve? What's realistic here to achieve? So I can't remember where I was going now, but I have to look at the person and say, okay, well, you actually need to lose X amount of weight. That's going to take a fat loss phase of this long. We're going to put that in month quarter 2 of the year. So we're going to work up, spend quarter 1 working up towards that fat loss phase to make it the most successful fat loss phase possible. And often what's missing in successful fat loss is not knowing how to reverse diet and not knowing what your maintenance calories is. So how to go back to maintenance, because what happens is generally when people stop dieting is they binge and then they eat too much food and then they end up putting all the weight back on. So even myself, as someone who's a seasoned dieter, and I wouldn't say a seasoned dieter, but I understand food and I don't overeat and all of those things. In my diet phase, I've planned an 8-week reverse dieting phase. So you have to get really good at tracking and hitting macros before you diet, because the refeed phase, I'm slowly increasing my calories over time and I need to hit those really well to ensure that I maintain all the weight that I've lost. So I hope this gives you some thoughts about what to focus on other than the scale weight. There's so many things that make up our health. Our health is not defined by what we weigh on the scale, nor is our fitness. You know, there's so many things that make up this. And also, like, I think it's really important to know that there's other things to focus on, because when you get to your goal weight, what are you going to do then? Did you get there by just being in a constant, like, extreme calorie deficit? Like, I was reading this story of this influencer the other day. She lost a lot of weight. She spent a year. So she lived in a caloric deficit for an entire year. And then I was following her on Instagram and I was like, oh, she only eats that much now, because she can't eat any more than that because she put the weight back on. So she's now stuck eating like 1,200 calories a day for the rest of her life to maintain that weight. So do you want to live your life like that? I don't want to live like that. I want to go out and have pizza and pasta with my friends and go on holiday and enjoy myself. And, you know, I also want to have muscle mass and I want to be strong and I want to snowboard with my daughter and horse ride with my daughter. And, you know, I don't want to live a life restricted in a little box to, you know, achieve something that's so unachievable. You know, it's really important to teach people to learn, like, what does my life look like day to day? What keeps me healthy day to day? Fat losses phases are just tiny little parts of the program. And I go on about them so much because this is how people get metabolic issues, is from too much dieting, restricting foods, overtraining relative to the amount of food coming in. Like, if you want to do ultra marathons, great, you can, but you probably need to eat like 3,000, 4,000 calories to be able to do them. Overtraining happens because of underfueling. So if we eat enough fuel, you can do a lot more training. So, you know, you have to learn to fuel yourself for what you want to do. So let me know what you think of this podcast episode. Stay tuned, because my course is coming in January. And if you're interested in applying all of this, you should definitely come and join. And yeah, I think this is going to be the last podcast episode before Christmas, because just like you, I'm going to need a break and I'm going to stay off social media as much as possible and just disengage from everything and enjoy the time with my family. But I hope this gives you something to think about over that Christmas break. I know Christmas is a bit weird. Everybody worries about seeing people that they haven't seen for a long time and what they're going to think of them and, you know, all of that stuff. But you know what? Christmas is there to enjoy. Eat all the food, you know, just enjoy yourself and don't worry about it. And if you are thinking about, you know, I'm not happy with myself and my weight, my health, maybe think about doing it differently instead of this new year jumping into another cleanse or diet or extreme restriction. Like, learn about what you need to do for the rest of your life so you don't have to constantly diet or restrict or cleanse or detox or whatever it is. So I'll leave you with that. Thanks for listening. Please send me any comments. I'm loving everyone's comments on YouTube, by the way. YouTube is going off. We only just moved onto there after Google got rid of their podcast. But I'm really enjoying all the comments from people. It helps me work out what I should create for you guys, because I'm here for you. And it helps me, yeah, just with content. And I really appreciate the feedback, even when it is, what's the word? Not negative, but it's constructive. I had a negative comment. I took it on board. I appreciated it. So thank you for listening and stay tuned for after Christmas, when we'll be dropping more episodes. I hope you have a wonderful festive season, everyone, and enjoy the break. Thanks for listening.
I'm Lena Lutz, and you've been listening to The Body Never Lies. If you haven't yet, please go to your favorite podcast app and subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. All the resources and references from this episode are waiting for you on my website, lenalutz.com. Just click on podcast and look for this episode. Now join me next week for another episode of The Body Never Lies. Thank you so much for listening.